the Tattooed Buddha Podcast. Join the dialogue at www.thetattooedbuddha.com.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As usual, I am Ty Phillips with my co-hosts Dana Gronau, Jonathan Pendle, and Daniel Scharpenberg. What's going on, guys? How you doing?
How's it going?
Hey.
Daniel's joining us by car again. We're interviewing over his phone.
He's being negligent again. Oh, he's not even looking at the road now, ladies and gentlemen.
Doing a podcast, staring at his phone, and driving.
Yeah.
Epic fail in mindfulness here.
Listen, I have Zen training. I can pay attention to as many things as I want.
Certified multitasker.
That was pretty good.
Ironically, a lot of things I read, one of the fundamentals was do not multitask, just do one thing at a time. And I'm like, I'm an American. I'm going to multitask.
You see your mouth, and it reminds me of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, with the lips at the beginning.
I have to tell you, I was on a retreat over the weekend, and one of the things you do on a Zen retreat is when you're eating, it's total silence. So you really just sit and eat. And I think we as Americans, we have no idea what that's like because we are always watching TV or reading or talking or something or messing with our phone or something while we're eating.
Or so, all of them together.
Yeah, so I spent a whole weekend on retreat, but the hardest and weirdest part was eating in silence.
Did you enjoy it, or did eating not seem as fulfilling when you're doing it mindfully?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more.
I find when I eat an apple mindfully, now I read TNH, he had a book about mindful eating, like the entire book was about that, and he was like talking about how to eat an apple mindfully, and I was eating an apple mindfully, and I was like, I don't want to finish eating this, it's going to take forever. I had like two bites, and I was like, all right, I'm done, I'll just put it back in the fridge for now.
Two bites and 600 chews later.
Yep.
For those of you unaware, TNH is Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah.
And his book, which I also have that book, but I can't recall the title. What's the title of that book, John?
I can't remember. My brain keeps saying Eat, Pray, Love, but that is something completely different.
Danny, you have that book too, don't you?
Is it Peace at Every Step?
No. It's specifically about food. I cannot remember the name of it.
He has written so many. Just like the Dalai Lama, he's written a lot of books.
I think there's like upwards of 100 books by Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, he's been a pretty prolific writer. Savor, that's what it's called.
That's right, Savor.
Mindful Eating, Mindful Life.
He co-wrote that with a Chinese physician, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he was a nutritionist, the guy he co-wrote it with, yeah.
Okay, it's a good book, actually. I enjoyed it. It's some of his books, not the ones for mass consumption that the most of us are aware of, but his more in-depth books are very weighty. They're almost encyclopedic in their depth.
Oh, I don't think I've read any of those. Most of the TNH ones I've read have been pretty fluffy.
Yeah, a lot of his books, like you can probably buy 70 of his books and it's essentially all the same book with a different title. But his heavy books like Zen Keys or The Heart of the Buddha, Savor, and he's got another one called How the Mind Works, I believe, are very in-depth, and it's almost a rarity compared to his other books.
But, yeah, I have The Heart of the Buddha's teaching, and when I read it, I realized, like, all the Zen teachings are in here.
Yeah, that's a really good book, too.
That's not normal for one book to have so much material, but, like, it's really extensive.
You're real quiet again, Dan.
It's really extensive, I said.
For people listening,
on the microphone.
Yeah, it looks like you're like 2 inches away from his top row of teeth right now.
Just quit looking.
Well, it takes up the whole screen.
Yeah, every time you talk, it just fills up my entire universe. Just your incisors right there.
It's like Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
This is not good radio.
Next thing, Tim Curry's going to come in dressed in drag and
He's another one of those people who has a voice that I could listen to if he was just reading the ingredients on the shampoo bottle.
Oh, it's excellent voice. Yeah.
He's so well spoken, and his diction and his accent and everything is just really mellifluous. It's amazing.
That's him and David Bowie. I don't know if you've seen, like, you know, David Bowie. Everybody knows David Bowie. Yeah. But his speaking voice, he actually did a narrative for Peter and the Rabbit, I think it was, like in an audiobook. I was like, I gotta listen to that. It sounds like it'd be amazing. Just Peter and the Rabbit by David Bowie.
The British biologist who narrates all the shows on like PBS and what have you. Older guy in his 80s.
I know who you mean, but
he's another one who could read the back of the box of Kellogg's and I'd just be sitting there enraptured. It's amazing.
And of course you got Carl Sagan who can just be talking right now and be like, we are on the Tattooed Buddha podcast featuring Carl Sagan. I remember the first time I saw The Cosmos, it was like 3 in the morning, and just his voice and the graphics I was watching, I was like, did I just drop acid? What's going on? My mind was just enraptured. This is amazing.
Were you like one when that aired? That aired.
I didn't know if I was alive. Wasn't it in the 70s?
I think it aired in 1980.
Yeah, you weren't alive, John.
No, I was born in 86.
Oh, my God.
Young person.
Yeah.
What are you, like 12? I'm not good at math.
Late 20s somewhere.
Oh, wow. So,
did we lose him?
I can see his giant teeth. But there he is.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So, let's try to get on topic here.
I think it's been pretty good so far.
There's been a lot of requests and stuff about the effects of meditation, and I know we wanted to branch out on that over the past couple of weeks. And I know that some people see a lot of these ridiculous claims by, you know, the New Age gurus and what have you, that meditation can change everything, and it, you know, it has amazing fluffy Puff the Magic Dragon influences on things. But I don't think a lot of people are aware of just the basic science of it. And I know Harvard's done a lot, University of British Columbia, Yale, Jon Kabat-Zinn, the Dalai Lama's Science and Mind annual conferences every year. There's been a lot of people done it, Professor Daniel Goleman. And I wanted just to bring up some of that stuff. And I know, John, you said you had done some research on that, if you wanted to go ahead and start us off with that.
I'm not going to go into all of it because we'd be sitting here for like 4 hours just talking about the effects that meditation has on the actual physical brain we're talking.
Mm-hmm. I know there's pretty common that it increases gray matter and more neurons are firing when you're meditating.
The first article I read was in the APA's Monitor. It was said that basically one of the things it does, frequent meditation, is it decreases gray matter in the amygdala, which, you know, controls fear, anger, stress, things like that, anxiety. And it also, at the same time, it increases gray matter in the, let me take a look here. I didn't even write it down because I thought it was that unimportant. It was too science-y. I don't want to science everybody out here. But it increases gray matter in certain areas that deal with attention and also other areas that deal with mood regulation. So in essence, this study showed that it makes you less stressful, less full of anxiety, and can also increase your attention and even out your moods.
That's what I had heard initially, was it decreases amygdala input and increases the size of prefrontal cortex, which is with general feelings of wellness and contentment and less aggressive mood swings and, you know, what have you. And for those also listening who aren't aware, the APA is the American Psychological Association.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Forgot to mention.
Also in the frontal lobe where you're able to make better decisions or something like that? It's the part of the brain where you can actually weigh, you know, choices?
Yeah, the frontal lobe has to do a lot with your executive functions. So things like language, rationality, reasoning, stuff like that, yeah. This study I was looking at, it actually, the first one I read had to do with the left hippocampus. That was the mood regulation part. And then it was the posterior cingulate, whatever. the mood regulation.
Whatever.
That's a scientific term. But that's just the beginning of it, boys and girls.
There has been research done by almost every major university across the United States, and I believe that Max Planck University in Germany has also done an extensive study on the effect of meditation. And when we're talking about meditation, we're talking specifically about meditation. Not to discriminate against any of the practitioners, but as that's the majority of our practice, we're referring specifically to Buddhist meditation here.
Well, these studies, a lot of psychologists, they actually break it down. They call it open monitoring meditation, which is like Zazen, Shikantaza, Mojiao, things like that. Then there's focused attention meditation, which is similar to Vipassana. Is that how you say that? Vipassana?
Vipassana, yeah.
Vipassana, yeah.
I've heard it called Vipassana.
Vipassana.
But I don't know.
Anyone ever noticed you can say Pali terms with an Italian accent? Vipassana! Yeah, that's just all of one study. Overall meditation, you know, we're talking dedicated meditation of either open monitoring style or focused meditation like Vipassana or a mantra meditation. It's changes literally the entire brain. One thing it changes part of the brain's have to do with sensory input. And so people that frequently meditate actually are more aware of their bodies and their surroundings. And even their sense of self is different, so that usually we have a narrative in life. Mm. But when you meditate frequently, there's not the clear separation between self and the environment. They're both included in the self-concept.
Mm-hmm.
And meditation boosts the immune system. It has reduces the effects of aging on the brain. It frequent meditators often require less sleep, and when they do sleep, it's more fitful. Yeah, it's just incredible, really, all of the physiological things meditation can do. The most interesting thing I found in my research was about wandering thoughts. I guess it turns out that wandering thoughts are pretty much the worst thing in the world for your brain. When your mind is wandering, actually entire areas of your brain shut down. And so that it's as if, especially the parts of the brain that have to do with being aware of what's going on around you. So, and the more your mind wanders, the more this happens. And eventually that can actually contribute to dementia and Alzheimer's.
I'm like in a constant state of wandering. Like, I'm not sure it's ever focused, ever. Ever.
I'm sure you focus more than you think you do.
When I'm writing, it's like not focused. Even when I'm editing, it's not focused. I don't think it's ever been focused.
Interesting. Well, you practice pranayama though, right?
Well, I follow along, but my brain isn't with it. You know, I actually and I don't know if this has anything to do with it, and this might be slightly off topic, slightly, but part of the training that I went through to become an interpreter was to be able to listen to conversation, translate it in my head, and put it out through my hands. And then while it's going out through my hands, I'm listening to the next thing that's being said and translating it. So there's a flow to it. It's not simultaneous. There's actually like a pause in it. So I have to be doing one thing with my hands and doing another thing with my brain. While I'm doing that, a lot of times there's another part of my brain that's thinking about like what I'm going to make for dinner and what I need to do later. So I sort of split up into all different parts all at the same time. And it's a skill that you have to be able to do. And I almost wonder if by doing that, I've sort of like messed up my brain a little bit because it's constantly focusing on more than one thing at a time. I don't know. I remember interpreting a psychology class one time, and the professor was trying to demonstrate that you couldn't listen to two conversations at once and understand both. And I interpreted both conversations at the same time, like by body shifts. And the professor was like, your brain is not supposed to be able to do that. In our training, we learned how to do that.
That'd be interesting to see how your brain reacts with an EEG and how your brainwave patterns shift and how they regulate or don't regulate when you try to concentrate.
Right. Yeah, I think it would be interesting to study interpreters, especially sign language interpreters, because, like I said, we're doing one thing with our gross motor skills and fine motor skills, and we're doing another thing with our brain and translating all at the same time.
So. I would imagine if you could find a way to regulate, it's really the only word that I can bring to mind, and apply that to like a shamatha meditation, or that there would have to be some type of amazing, profound outcome to that, I would think, if you learned how to regulate that.
You know, I'm practicing Mojiao now, silent illumination. You might actually like that, Dana. It's because it does involve taking your attention and in a way relegating it to so many different spots at once, and then making it equal among all areas. Like, you start with the body, you literally try to pay attention to every single point on your body at the same time. It's so difficult to do that it's hard to have even wandering thoughts, because so much of your attention just has to be placed on that focus. But I had another thought in there, too, but it completely just dissolved into nothingness.
I read a meditation book one time that said you can't really pay attention to two sensations at once. So if you put your hands on two different objects, like, you can technically only feel one at a time. And if you can slow your brain down to feel one and then the other, it could be a meditation practice.
I've heard that too. I think it's complete and utter BS. I have heard that.
I don't know. I'm trying to remember what book I read. But it said a helpful meditation technique is to find a sensation between two different feelings that you can feel with your body.
A sensation between two different feelings?
Yeah, like a gap in between when you're trying to feel two things at once.
Like the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath?
Sort of like that. Sort of like the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath. Or the space between thoughts, yeah.
But in what you're reading, this was two physical sensations instead.
Right. If you have your hands on two different objects, like a hand, like one hand is in water and the other hand is like on a table.
And then resting with the mind as it transfers between sensations.
Between feeling what each hand feels like, yeah.
So basically what they're saying is that, like, right now when I put both my hands on the sides of this chair, my attention is actually bouncing back and forth between the two rapidly.
Right. That's right. That's the speculation behind it. I don't know if there's any scientific basis between
them. Yeah.
I know, like, squeeze something when you're in pain, like that kind of thing kind of helps with pain management. I don't know.
Diverting attention from the pain to the squeezing.
Right.
In a separate object.
I don't know. I'm talking out of my ass. It's probably
sound very similar to shamatha. Basically just, it seems like a reformatting version, whereas you're not paying attention to the breath, you're paying attention. Well, with shamatha, you're looking for that gap between breaths, and you're just looking between that gap between sensations.
Right. I remembered. It's called Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha.
Who wrote it?
Daniel Ingram.
I don't like it already. No, I'm just
Daniel
kidding.
Ingram. he's actually not well-liked in the Buddhist community. Hmm. But
neither am I.
His... He's one of those teachers that goes around saying, I'm enlightened. But he studied in the Theravada tradition. It's a pretty good book, though. I sometimes read books by people that aren't well-liked.
I kind of like that idea. Forbidden books, but... So this is a white guy studying Theravada saying he's enlightened.
Yeah.
What is your gut reaction when you hear somebody say, I'm enlightened?
No, you're not. Every great teacher I've ever encountered, including the Dalai Lama, has said, I'm really not that special.
Yeah.
When you have somebody saying, hey, look at me, I'm enlightened, my reaction is probably, no, you're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always get the impression that it's their ego more than anything else. But yeah. Then again, you have the ancient Theravada teachings with Buddha, or after he was supposedly, you know, Anattara Samyak Sambodhi, he was like, that's it. My journey is over. I am enlightened.
I really hope he said it like that.
This is Nirvana.
I'll never get that picture of the Buddha screaming that out of my head.
Enlightened. I was on a retreat with Karen Mazin Miller, a Zen teacher, and she told me, if someone says, I'm enlightened or I'm a master, you should be suspicious right away.
Yeah, and even the Buddha said that, did he not? He told his teachers or his students to be even wary of his
teachers.
Well, he told us, yeah, his students to be skeptical of everything in general, so.
So while he said that he had found enlightenment for himself, he still told those people, don't accept this.
Mm-hmm.
Put it into practice. Right. If it doesn't work, walk away. So, yeah. But there's quite a few, unfortunately, teachers like that. And speaking of that, we're talking about the effects of meditation. I see a lot of frivolous quotes and articles and like the Natural News websites who come out with, you know, eat an apple stem and you've cured cancer or something like mm-hmm. that. Very similar to these claims on meditation, like the Transcendental Meditation Group, where they cross their legs and they're literally hopping on the floor saying that they're levitating. I don't know if you've seen the videos. They're hilarious. I would love to see somebody dub something funny over the
Yeah.
Yeah, this article was making the rounds on Facebook recently, and it goes around once in a while, and it says, meditation literally changes society. Studies were done in the 70s that indicate that 1% of the population, if they meditate, crime goes down drastically, and everybody's nicer to each other. Just, you know, New Age thinking, I guess.
Yeah, they call that Maharishi effect, I think, is what they term it.
TM, I don't think
$1,000, I'll show you how it works.
Yeah, I don't think we really think about it now, but TM was the first organization to suggest that meditation could be studied by science and to go looking for scientific benefits. And of course, we already talked about it. We know there are scientific benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the first ones to really get studies out there. So
the first ones in the United States?
In the United States. To associate it with measurable health benefits.
See, that I can completely agree with because, you know, we do have the facts as they stand that it definitely does have an effect on our body and mind. But to think it actually has a metaphysical effect on the world around us, that's a little bit different.
Between that and the flying, I think that just they wanted to find ways to make more money because mm-hmm. once you pay the $1,000 and learn how to meditate and get your mantra, you're done. So they had to find ways to get those people to spend more.
Right.
CrossFit and spiritual community. You gotta pay $1,000 every year to renew your mantra.
Right.
Renew your mantra now and have another mantra for free.
from what I'm told, the one good quality of TM is when you pay that money, you have a coach, and you're not allowed to make excuses. You have to check with your coach and say, I meditated this long, and it's just shame is the method to get you to keep meditating.
Well, that's healthy.
Just yeah. It's embarrassing if you don't. Yeah, well, if it works, it works. But I don't have $1,000 to spend on that.
Shame does wonders.
So, but yeah, I can just make up a mantra, whatever.
I think
there we go.
Anytime you have to pay for something like that, just like when somebody claims to be enlightened, if they're giving you spiritual teaching for money, the best course of action is to turn around and go the other way.
Yeah, as quickly as humanly
possible.
Yeah,
there's a difference between taking donations and charging exorbitant fees.
Yeah. Definitely. And he's out again. Poof.
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
Okay.
I'll be right back. Talk amongst yourselves.
Oh, okay.
We're Buddhists. We don't have cells.
that was good. That timing was right on that. For those of you who aren't completely familiar with the process, Dana is the lifeblood behind Tattooed Buddha. And all of the good stuff that ever happens there is because of her, and all of the crappy stuff that ever happens is probably because of me. So, if you're listening, clap your hands for Dana.
That is not true.
And for those who are listening, we wanted to say thank you for your support, and it's been very encouraging to see how many shares and likes we've had already, and all of us wanted to say thank you. We've been very flattered by your support. If anyone out there who's got questions or topics that you want us to address, by all means, post it on the main page or the writer's page or, you know, send us a query at editor@thetattooedbuddha.com or ty@thetattooedbuddha.com. Shoot us your questions. You know, what do you want us to talk about? What do you want us to debunk or, you know, anything like that?
One other question I wanted to ask, actually, for this podcast. What type of meditation or contemplative practices do all of us do? And how do you meditate, basically, and what do you do?
I'm very partial to a basic shamatha practice. It has done, I don't want to say it's worked wonders for me in some esoteric, weird way, but it's worked wonders for me. It's I've been doing it for probably going on 5 years now with strictly just a shamatha practice, and it's gotten deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and I've been able to use that to certain variances working with specific emotions and what have you, and I'm stuck with that practice, and it's been good to me, or whatever. We've been good to each other. What about you?
Originally started with Shikantaza when I went into Zen, and I did that for about 2 years, and then I discovered Koan Zazen, and that completely rocked my world, and then I lost my teacher and ran out of Koans, so now I'm doing Silent Illumination, which is the Chan version of Shikantaza. A little bit different, but it's same kind of idea. But then I basically just take my attention, and I still approach it, even though there's no koan, I put the same energy into it that you would have with a koan, where it's just like just pushing forward, you know? And there's a little of the samatha in that for me, too, with the relaxation aspect. But I also use that kind of intense vitality in sitting, too.
Yeah. What about you, Daniel?
My main practice is just following the breath, just breath counting practice, which I can't really say much about because it's really not that interesting. But in addition to that, I sometimes do Watto practice, which is just keeping a question in mind and following a question over and over.
I've done that as well, too.
Is that how I pronounce that?
I think it's Watto. I don't know, but from what I understand, it's predates koan practice, and it's actually what inspired koan practice. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not a historian, but
I always mispronounced it huat tao, and that's like when you have a question in your mind, like who is this, you know, and things like that. I guess isn't that what it is?
Yeah, and it's odd to me. Like we have things like we say silent illumination instead of zazen sometimes, but we don't have another word for Watto. We don't have an English word because it's not well known enough in the West.
What about you, Dana?
Well, I'm not as fancy as you guys, so I don't have like all these fancy words and everything like that. But I used to use Headspace, actually, which he has a book out. I can't think of the name of it right now. Where I read that, and I used his app and everything, and that really helped me because he sort of would talk you into kind of a relaxed state, which gave my brain something to focus on a little bit because, like I said, I have trouble focusing. And now if I meditate, which I don't meditate every day, it's usually about 5 to 10 minutes, and it's just trying to settle my brain. I don't think that I get too much into a deep state. There are times when it's a little better than others, and there's times when I just give up. So I'm still sort of like a baby meditator.
Have any of you used mantra meditation?
I used to quite a bit. In my high school, that's what I first used. I would just do Om, you know. There's been some studies into mantra or chants and prayers as well with the brain, and I guess they do activate parts of the brain that control some mood regulation, the limbic system, which, you know, makes it seem like it's a nice reward process. And it also, let me see what else they do. Oh, they also activate the temporal lobe a lot, which anybody that has epilepsy probably knows that when they have a seizure, it's usually if it's in the temporal lobe. And so a lot of that's why some people with epilepsy have visions of godliness and things like that. Yeah. And so with mantra meditation, chanting, and even active prayer, like the Christian contemplative do, those are pretty common because of the temporal lobe activity.
The mantra meditation is something that I also use daily. I actually, and I know this is frowned upon, but I actually put myself to sleep with it every night. I have two sets of beads, my cheap beads and my expensive beads. I go to sleep with my cheap beads, and I do the mantra, and I probably do it several thousand times a night until I'm out. And it, I don't want to say it's a sleep aid, but it is a sleep aid. like the entire day, everything that I'm carrying with me, I just kind of let it go. And I'm so focused on the mantra and relaxing, and everything just kind of fades away. And I'll be having communication with people. I'll be texting Dana, or I'll be texting somebody else, or emailing something, and then it's just, I'm gone. And I just get so absorbed in it, and the next thing I know, it's morning.
Huh.
But it's, I know it changes your brain waves. And I'm grasping at words here. I know what I'm thinking, but
You get the delta and theta waves going, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And it completely changes that focus for me, and it's also been amazing for me, especially when I had all those times in the hospital when I was dealing with my health 4 years ago. That was a constant for me, and it was probably one of the few things that got me through because of the level of anxiety that I was experiencing with, you know, tubes in my heart and my chest and all this other stuff. It's really overwhelming, and I was by myself 90% of the time with this, and it was, again, a lifesaver in an emotional sense.
What is your mantra, if you don't mind sharing?
I use the six-syllable mantra, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. And when I'm in the woods, I do the Naga mantra, which is personal for me in my tradition and part of my ordained name, because I have such an unusual connection. When I first got ordained and first started studying, every time I left the house, there were snakes everywhere. Had never seen them before, huge black snakes. And I've been hiking in the woods around here for my entire life, and it probably very coincidental, might have been the season, could have been the rains, could have been who knows what it was, but they were all over the place all the time. And I was posting all over Facebook hundreds of pictures of all these snakes that were constantly around me, and my teacher started referring to me as Naga. And then when I got ordained, it just kind of stuck, the whole thing. I was the Naga, and oddly enough, like the first hike of the spring this year, my first hike, I went out, and the black snake head, he was poking his head out of the tree, and like we greeted each other on the first day of spring, and it's happened every year since. When I'm in the woods, I do the Naga mantra, and when I'm sleeping, I do the six-syllable mantra.
You're like Lord Voldemort. Got the parcel tongue going on.
I'm talking parcel tongue.
At the Buddhist temple I go to, part of our practice, we sing the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, and we used to chant the Vajrasattva mantra, Om Vajrasattva Hum, which is a purification mantra, but then they turned it into a song, so we sing that one too, which makes me sad because I liked chanting it better. When I read Be Here Now, I started doing Ram Dass's mantra for a little while, which is just Ram, 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 Ram. Mm. And I enjoyed that one, and I do that sometimes when I feel like doing a mantra.
Mm.
Well, look it up, because I'm not going to tell you.
That's fair.
Are you guys familiar with the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying? Not the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche?
I didn't like it very much.
Really?
Sorry. Yeah.
I loved it. I have actually read that book.
Everybody likes it. I didn't like it that much.
Always the outlier, Daniel.
Yeah.
For a while there, I was using a mantra, too, that I made. It was, what was it? See, I've forgotten it now, because I don't care about it anymore. Chitta Kewalo, which was like the Pali for mind only. That was after I read the Lankavatara Sutra. I was all into mind only there for a while.
Didn't you, like, just read the Lankavatara Sutra?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was like a week. There was like a week where I was like, mind only, mind only, mind only. Now I'm like, I'm going to have a drink.
Oh, my God. Guru Rinpoche mantra is Om Aham Vajra Guru Padmasiddhi Hum. And if for Tibetan Buddhists, Guru Rinpoche is monumental in the Tibetan tradition. He essentially kind of brought everything into focus for Tibetan Buddhism and was considered by many the patriarch of Tibetan Buddhism. So that mantra is almost as influential as the six-syllable mantra as well, and I've used that one quite a bit.
Modern researchers here in the West, psychologists anyway, they consider mantras to be a form of focused attention meditation.
Yeah.
And just like if we look at a candle, that was a big one back in the day too, you know, and things like that. Focusing on anything singular is under that category.
I think the candle thing a long, long, long time ago, probably 20 years ago, and it just hurt my eyes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't blink. I'd just stare at it, and then my eyes would be all watering, and then they'd dry out, and then they'd start burning, and I'm like, screw this.
I took a Kundalini yoga class for a little while, and we did Wahe Guru. I did another one, too. I don't remember. It was interesting. We did it, like, in combination with yoga. It was interesting. Totally different type of yoga than what I'm used to.
How long did you do it?
About a year.
Did you like it, or you just... kind of
I liked it, yeah. It was she was not only an occupational therapist, but she was also a yoga teacher, and she did yoga therapy with me separately, outside of yoga, because I was going through some like depression and some issues and everything like that. So she was working with me. I was trying just about everything at the time. And so, you know, she had me doing some really funky stuff. Like, yeah, just really, like, breath work and stuff, like, blowing out my nose and, like, you know, mantras and all kinds of spinning around in circles. Hmm. It's kind of crazy now when I think about all the stuff. She's like, oh, do this. I was, okay. So I you know, just sort of, like, desperate trying to get out of, like, that depressed mood. So, but it was interesting.
Now, some of those techniques, especially when you mentioned, like, the spinning around, kind of reminds me of what Osho used to have some people do. You guys know Osho or
Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh?
Yeah, the guy with the Cadillacs.
What was Rolls Royces?
Rolls. Oh, don't be Rolls ridiculous. Sorry, he had 100 Rolls Royces. Don't be ridiculous.
And 100 Rolexes to go with them. And a big building full of naked women, and that was his thing.
Yeah. And a big beard. He had a big white beard, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, didn't he lace a salad bar with
No, that wasn't him, Ty.
His assistant did it.
His followers.
Allegedly.
Oh, yeah.
Allegedly.
He was only convicted of being in the country illegally.
Yeah.
And poisoning a whole town, allegedly. We accidentally sprayed everything with salmonella. We didn't mean to do it.
So... Yeah, he was definitely probably not a good guy, but his books are really good, man.
A lot of what I've seen, it's mostly just paraphrasing. It's a lot of parroting.
Commentary. He has a commentary on the Diamond Sutra that's actually really good.
Yeah.
I read about his meditation style that he taught, and I really don't want to try it. It involves things like jumping up and down and yelling and
screaming, and yeah.
And the motivation is he thought Westerners couldn't really do silent meditation. I think that's racist and insulting, and I don't agree. But, yeah, I would never go to his community or anything, but his books have good information in them, I think.
Hmm.
I met a guy who was a follower of Osho or Rajneesh or whatever you want to call him, and he had this whole thing that he was going to start his own ashram and do this thing, and he wanted me to show me the blueprints, and so he whips out these actual blueprints, and it was a land map with blueprints on it, excuse me, so it had the woodland area and where they were going to put the roads, and then the drawing for the building, and as I'm looking at this, I'm noticing that there are stick figures with boobs all over it. He was really modeling himself after Rajneesh.
Wow.
Don't you do that when you draw things, too?
Yeah, I don't think I really have. Oh, wait. There's another tie-in. Yeah, there actually are there are several different types of therapy that implement meditation now, actually. And a lot of them have been very effective on people that had a lot of abuse or traumatic childhoods. And especially people who experience a lot of relapse episodes for depression. And so if anybody's listening that's had any of those things, then can look into it. I'm going to post the links to where I got all my information at in the description of the podcast.
I started meditating in the first place because I had really debilitating anxiety, and it was recommended to me by a therapist. So that's how I got here.
I started, it's one thing I've noticed for a long time in the Buddhist community and any kind, especially contemplative practices in general, is that most of us had very miserable lives before we started getting into the Dharma and getting into meditation and things like that.
Yeah, suffering and the way out of suffering is, I mean, it brings in people that are suffering, right?
Yeah. It's medicine, you know?
That it does. Well, we got to wrap it up this week, guys. We've been on here for a while. And as usual, thank you for tuning in. I'm Ty, and as usual, my co-hosts Dana, Daniel, and Jonathan, thanks for joining us again. And until next week, we will see you later.
Really, really, really got to pee. I can wait like one more minute.
I'm sorry we were so scattered on this podcast, everyone.
Don't apologize to them.
Many tangents, I think.
You cannot delete the I gotta pee part. You have
to. No, I'm leaving this whole thing in. This is our outro conversation.